Welcome to the second edition of the New Rural Advocate podcast. I'm here on this cold October night with two friends, Seva Tower and Callian Uprichard. Yeah. All right. And they are the proprietors, I don't know if that's the right name,
caretakers
of, say the full name of your farm.
Nutwood Farm?
Nutwood Farm. As simple as that. All right. And they live in Cummington, Massachusetts, and they came over tonight to chat with me. So, all right, let's just get right into it. First question, tell me about your farm. Tell everybody about your farm, because it's a really unique experiment. And
well, it's nuts. Let's start with that.
It's nuts. You guys are the nut farmers.
We found this piece of property thanks to our next door neighbor who said that it had been on the market but no one bought it. I wonder why. It was pretty much a jungle. Bird sanctuary is another way of saying it.
Bramble patch.
Bramble patch. And had been a Christmas tree farm that was abandoned, basically, clear cut, destroyed, abandoned, and hadn't been touched for about 20 years. So we thought it'd be perfect place to start a farm.
Well, I mean, these days, real estate's so premium that, you know, if you're an aspirant farmer, most people in that position don't have a lot of assets to begin with, and so, you know, you're going to be working the marginal turf, right?
You call it a fixer-upper.
A fixer-upper farm.
Without any buildings to fix up.
But land open.
My land.
You know, The lot was a little bit imposing in how many thorns were on it and just how dense it was.
Impassable.
Yeah. Alright. So, you guys cleared it out.
Been working on that for 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Still working on that.
Still working. What happened next?
Well, I'd met you around town, but became aware when you did the GoFundMe and kind of let everybody know.
Barn raiser, but yes.
Yeah.
A what? Barn raiser?
Barn raiser,
okay.
Was the
good
site we used.
Sounds better. But yeah, like a crowdfunding for your farm and to plant trees and to build a storage unit at barn, yep. Right?
Yeah. So we've been doing that. We've done that, I guess, and are continuing to do that.
So how many trees did you plant?
We've got 600 and counting.
650. We have 630 hazelnuts.
Hazelnuts and another
200 odd trees, other
things.
Trees of several varieties.
Okay.
Fruit, nuts, wild edibles.
Yeah.
Oh, we
perennials.
Have a small orchard, and then we have Chinese and American hybrid chestnuts and English walnuts and butternuts and heartnuts and
pawpaws
and butternut heartnut crosses and hearty pecans.
Cool.
Kiwis.
And I know you guys did a lot of site work like trenching and I don't know what you call
it. We have an extensive swale and berm. Our whole field of nut trees is planted on contour on top of ditch and mound or swale and berm earthworks, and where we dig a swale on contour and build a berm right below it.
To retain water and then release
swale
it.
Swale catches water and sinks it into the aquifer, so we're recharging our water system and thus giving the trees that are planted on the berm access to moisture in dry times of year where the swale catches it and stores it. And in the wet, when the heavy rainfall comes, the trees are still high and dry and they're not getting swamped.
Uh-huh. How did that fare this summer?
It's great.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it's been wet.
Been a wet year.
So, have you guys harvested yet?
Yes.
We got our first day hazelnuts this year.
Very little, but they're coming.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Our first year planting bore about 5 pounds.
And hazelnuts.
Hazelnuts.
Are there markets, local markets?
You can buy them at River Valley.
Okay.
And they're importing them from Turkey at the moment.
Okay. So there's no local markets, really.
There's no local production.
Production.
Mm-hmm. There is a market.
Market. Yeah.
We think there's a market.
Yeah.
People eat a lot of nuts. Mm-hmm. They just don't think of it as a commodity. True.
And I think a lot of people who are somewhat informed would be happy to substitute a local hazelnut with a Californian almond any day, if they knew.
If they know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When they know.
Yeah.
So, why did you choose this particular path? Did you know this is what you wanted to do, or was it like, okay, this is the land, and this, mm-hmm. we have to figure out what's going to grow on it?
It's kind of both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We knew we wanted to grow tree crops. And we found the land and then began a process between the two of us of figuring out what we wanted to grow. And so that was part art market analysis of determining what was currently being produced in our region. And there was zero commercial nut production in Massachusetts, except for a few small farms that sell chestnuts in season fresh. But no one processing or value adding and no significant commercial production at all. Some small backyard plantings. And
right.
So what's the value adding that you, or where do you see this going? I mean, it's a lot of trees.
Nut crops are oil crops.
Mm.
Something that we don't have a lot of production in that category of foodstuffs in New England at all. Now, people grow sunflowers for sunflower oil, but hazelnuts are higher in oil than sunflowers. 60% oil. Of the, 60% of the nut is oil, and it's a very high quality oil.
Mm-hmm.
It's a frying oil that has good flavor, so you can use it as a salad oil. And it has high in tocopherols, or vitamin E, which is a natural preservative, and thus has a very long shelf life, as long as it's raw.
Mm-hmm. So you guys got a plan. How long did you dream about doing something like this?
In my case, not very long.
But you've jumped in with both feet.
I've jumped in with both feet. I think for me it was more a process of elimination.
Yeah.
Like, I knew I didn't want to be a CSA vegetable farmer for the rest of my life.
That's what you were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Various, manifestation, mm-hmm. or whatever,
uh-huh.
of that. And it's a lot of work, and the price points are pretty pitiful. And you're doing the same thing every single year, year after year. You're planting your crop, you're tending your crop, you're harvesting your crop. Mm-hmm. Next year, plant, tend, yeah. harvest, sell. It's the mm-hmm. same pattern, and it's exhausting, and you need a ton of labor,
mm-hmm.
and you got to be smart about it. Otherwise, you're just going to run yourself into the ground. So just looking for other models, and so perennial agriculture really stood out to me. It's like you plant it once, you take care of it, and you could walk away. And have a productive system. I mean, tending it obviously makes it more productive and, bountiful for human consumption, but it's something that benefits the entire ecosystem as opposed to just trying to carve out a piece of land and farm it to produce human food, which has no benefit for anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a really big draw for me.
How about you?
I kind of fell in love with tree crops a long time ago. And for me, I was very clear that I like growing vegetables, but I didn't want to do it for anyone else. A big issue with vegetable production being that they're very perishable crops. So there's a lot of uncertainty when you're growing a perishable crop, because there's the pressure is on as soon as you plant it that you need to be able to harvest it timely, you need to be able to store it, you need to be able to bring it to market right away. And then there's, of course, the tilling. With annual crops, you have to be continually disturbing the soil, which every time you break the soil, rain falls on it and washes part of it away. So soil erosion statistics are rather depressing in this country if you care to look at them. And we've lost more soil than we have.
Yeah.
But with tree crops also, like nuts, are actually highly storable instead of perishable, and you dry them a little bit and they store for years.
Right.
And they don't need refrigeration.
Yeah.
Right.
Dry storage.
So it sounds like you guys have been thinking about permaculture as an alternative to stay in farming, but not be,
permaculture is a word that we sometimes avoid using.
Okay, tell me why.
There's a little bit of a stigma around it in some communities because it's seen as this very new idea, which it's not. That, you know, someone coined the term about 40 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm. Two white men in Australia.
Yeah. But most of what permaculture is talking about is actually reclaiming indigenous techniques. And doing so, you know, producing food in a more ecological manner, where you're actually, you know, taking responsibility for or your food production by not being destructive in the process of it. So not losing soil every time you plant your food or harvest your food or walk in your field, and producing food that will stick around. Like if we walked away from our trees, they'd still be there in 10 years, in 20 years, you know, in 100 years, those same species would still be in that field, even if the same trees might not be.
So I hear you saying, for you, is it an investment?
Absolutely. It's an investment in, it all comes down to soil for me, because soil is the only thing that can grow continually without taking from something else.
Our economy does not fit that same description.
No. Whereas soil can, you know, we used to have 4 feet of topsoil that have gone down the river in the last 300 years. And so, you know, we call ourselves carbon farmers as much as nut farmers, because really our intention is to build the soil back up. If it takes 500 years, it takes 500 years.
But it doesn't have to.
It does not have to. We, you know, that the old idea of like an inch of soil taking 1,000 years in an undisturbed forest, that was first of all prior to the introduction of earthworms. Mm-hmm. onto this continent, which came with the European colonists. Uh-huh. And the ballast of the ships, they actually filled the ships with soil and took lumber and other things back to Europe. They just dumped the soil on the beach and brought all kinds of weeds and soil organisms with them.
Oh, yeah.
That they just weren't thinking about at all. Earthworms along with them.
Grass as well.
Grass and numerous small
invasive
annual
species.
Weeds.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah.
So we're born in invasives, this continent. This iteration.
We are the invaders.
Yeah.
You know, we are all Europeans
that
have come to this continent that does not belong to us. We have displaced its peoples and shoved them out west and claim that we have the right to it, our God-given right to, you know, multiply and destroy. But we don't have to. We can choose another way.
Mm-hmm. How much of this are you doing for yourselves to sustain, and how much are you trying to set a model or an example or be part of a possibility of changing things? This is a multi-part question. You can grab it by any handle. And let's put it another way would be, what is the vision you see? I mean, if people did completely invert their thinking in this kind of way, what would happen?
I'll start and I'll let you finish. But you know, we really started in thinking about it as a demonstration farm, and that yes, we want to start a commercial business where we can pay off our debts and, you know, the land and everything, and be able to make a living off of this land as full-time farmers and not have to work off-site, at least in some indefinite future. You know, when the land is producing more than we need, because we need to at least pay taxes. But first and foremost, we consider ourselves homesteaders, where we are trying to live as lightly as we can, which to us means reducing our needs by doing for ourselves, which means taking advantage of food that's in season and preserving it and putting aside so we don't have to buy it in January if it's available in June. It means picking raspberries and berries all year and know, yeah. I make my own wine and yeah. just doing everything that we can do to live lighter. And that's an ecological statement. That's choosing, like, not to commute to work, or if we don't have to. You know, our goal being to sell our car once we don't need it anymore and actually get, you know, electric bicycles. Because yeah. then we take a big carbon footprint, a big, you know, piece that we're still burning, and eliminate it. Just like we are off-grid solar, and we don't use our generator anymore. We still have it as a backup. We're probably going to sell it at some point, but once yeah. we know that we don't need it. But...
Yeah. Yeah, what do you
think? I guess one thing I think a lot about you're bringing up right now is just all the compromises that we make on a daily basis, and we all do it because we have to. We're just living in this world that we, by and large, don't agree with a lot of things that are happening, but yet we have to get through the day, we have to pay bills, we have to feed children, we have to, you know, work jobs and do these things so that we can survive. In this sort of society that we've set up. So we make these compromises and we, you know, we have cars and we do these, we fight wars to get oil to put in our cars and whatever else. So I think for us, you know, as much as possible, you know, with that sense of realism, like, what can we do to reduce those compromises, or at least to, like, more and more align ourselves with a way of life that
doesn't require
doesn't require making so many compromises. And it's a hard thing, and we're going to spend the rest of our lives, you know, making those decisions and choices and tweaking things. And, you know, we talk about oil, like, you know, it's certainly a part of the kitchen, you know, daily food prep that not a lot of thought gets put into, understandably, because you can buy olive oil pretty cheaply from California or
Greece
or wherever it comes from, and that's a cooking oil. But it's like, well, you know, it's also a compromise because it takes some resources to get that here. And, you know, if we had an alternative, if we could produce an oil here, then we could incorporate that into our diets, and that's a cool thing.
Yeah.
So
one of the premises behind doing the New Rural Advocate is that there are communities, I see this one as one of them, at least in terms of any of the places I live, more of that, where people are consciously experimenting with an alternative, you know, and I don't know too many people who are doing it as significantly as you guys are, even though, and I know you say you've got compromises, you know, I mean, I agree, we talk about it all the time,
yeah.
what we'd like to be doing, what we could be doing, what we are doing, but I see that a lot of people I know here are taking at least a portion of what they might be doing, whether it's time or resources or energy or money, and saying, I'm going to try to put this towards, like, some way of forming an alternative type of community. So I wonder what, you know, do you feel that this is a community? Could you do this anywhere? Or do you feel that, you know, there's some quality, or maybe just speak to what is that quality that you think is helping to support this kind of activity and makes you want to do it here?
I don't have a good answer.
Well,
And if it's the wrong question, just throw it out, because I think you get a sense of what I'm trying to get at, which is what is it about? I don't know. Comment on the You can criticize the community as well, but what is it, or what needs to be for this type of thing to, you know, so it's more than just two people on a nut farm, right? How do we assist each other? How does that take on a greater life, a greater force than, you know, a lot of people seem to want it. Some people put their money where their mouth is more than others. But what is it going to take to get that wheel turning, that flywheel?
Well, yeah, I guess I would say, I mean, I see the possibility here more than I have in other places, I guess. And if I had to put my finger on it, I mean, it's people like you and Kim. It's like other younger folks who have moved to this area more recently who kind of have been inspiring me to, like, keep, you know, pushing forward with these ideas. you know, I think that Massachusetts in general, you know, has some things going for it. Not everything, but some things. And I was living in Pennsylvania before, and I was kind of faced with this decision of, do I stay in Pennsylvania, in central Pennsylvania, where nothing is happening, really, and, like, fight like hell for the little things, or do I go back home to Massachusetts, where there is already kind of a base, or at least some movement towards, you know, in this direction, and push it further. Like, I felt like I had the opportunity to push that envelope even further in Massachusetts, whereas if I stayed in Pennsylvania, it would be kind of fighting for the basic things. And, you know, when I lined them both up, I ended up here. Because I felt like this work was more exciting, and it was more interesting to me to challenge people's thinking, you know, with a nut farm versus, like, starting, you know, the first CSA vegetable farm in this county in Pennsylvania or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be innovative, and I felt like this place could support innovation.
Huh. Interesting.
I would speak to you a little differently, but we all both have our own experiences, and I really fell in love with this area myself. I think I've been in this area since, I want to say, 08. You know, what I call the Plainfield-Worthington-Cummington triangle. I won't limit myself to Cummington exclusively here, because I came to this area through Earth Dance. Actually, Earth Dance was what hooked me.
I was suspicious of that.
I won't deny it. I lived there for 3 years.
That's a dance
retreat.
Intentional, and it started as an intentional community on some level.
It was six people, but yes,
yeah.
it collapsed in that existence, and then created itself as a retreat center.
Yes. And yet another wild and woolly and cool resource out here, which we seem to be learning about new ones every day that are just right next door, practically.
You know, and some people think of the Western Massachusetts, you know, if you're coming from the eastern part of the state or something, or from a more metropolitan area, as it's just the boonies, it's the sticks, there's nothing out there. But then you hear about Earth Dance or Double Edge or... You know, there's
an artistic community,
these
theater community,
number
experimental.
Of different artistic communities that have found themselves out in these hills, not to mention the Cummington community of the arts that no longer exists.
Yep.
But existed there for 100 years on Potash Hill.
Yeah.
Right up until the 1970s.
Yep.
And so this area, I feel like it breeds some creativity or something that, you know, obviously not everyone expresses, but that is potential at least. But for me, it was the people, actually. I came here and found enough like-minded people that it just encouraged me that I should try to just stay here and root you got to root somewhere eventually. You know, they say you always have to go home eventually, right? But for some of us who were born rootless, that's really a big question mark. It's like, where is home? Like, I grew up in a big family, but I was born outside of Philly in a little cottage in the woods. You know, the third child, and you know, my family lived there all of 6 months. I never knew the place, and we've been moving since. And the longest I ever lived was in Heath. I actually lived there for a whole 8 years, but we were renting. Always have been. We've never owned any land. So I consider myself, up until 3 years ago, completely rootless in that sense, and actually having a connection to the land that I could call my own or the place where I was from. I hope to eventually consider myself from Cummington.
Good luck.
Whatever, I won't argue with locals.
Well, it's an aspiration.
It's an aspiration, exactly. To know a place well enough that you could call it your own.
Yeah.
I have said to Kim, like, what if we just lived here for another 50 years? Right here. Like,
yeah.
Wouldn't that be an experiment?
Mm-hmm.
See what happens. Could be interesting.
You know, and at the same time, I think that what we're doing, you could do anywhere.
Yeah.
It really just requires a piece of land, and ultimately it's about looking at the land first. and not deciding what you want to drop on it, and, you know, name what you want to be until you actually get to know the land and what it wants to host. And, you know, we really tried to do that. We found the land first, walked it a few times, started talking to the landowner. Literally had like 5 months of phone conversations before we finally purchased it, you know, with an owner finance mortgage, which was also made it much more accessible. If we hadn't gone through a real estate company, it would have been $20,000 more or so. And, you know, then the homeowner doesn't get it all either because its commission goes to the real estate. So owner finance mortgages, good things for everyone concerned.
I mean, but also just connecting to the people who are here.
Yeah.
You know, if someone owns land and isn't using it, you know, those relationships become foundational to, you know, the birth of something new.
Help to make it possible.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, he's, you know, an old Italian guy, but he liked our spirit. You know, he didn't know what we were talking about. He had no idea, you know, nut trees and none of that. But it was like, you know, we're out to, like, do for ourselves and, you know, work hard, and he respected that. And
So
I'll help you out.
Pulled himself up by his own bootstraps. And
there's that narrative, right? It's so powerful.
Yeah.
Can't get away from it.
Well, I do find that people get to know each other in this community. They make a point of it.
And it's small enough that that's possible. Well, what we're doing is really about, you know, not trying to recreate anything that's never been done. It's more like going backwards and saying, actually, we don't have to do all these things that everyone says you have to do. We don't have to own a tractor. We don't have to. I'm a little bit of a student of Fukuoka and his philosophy of the not doing philosophy. It's like taking all the experts' advice and not following it. Because in Japan, just like in this country, industrialism, you know, just flooded in and started giving everyone advice that they didn't actually need and wasn't actually good. And he saw it as that, and he decided to do differently. And he was actually a biologist studying plant ant pests.
I'll look up Fukuoka after this. It's news to me.
Masanobu Fukuoka, known for his first book, The One Straw Revolution.
Well, we started late. We're pushing a little late, so I might cultivate a conversation further. Otherwise, but less is more, and I can always have you back on the show. So let me just thank you, Kalyan Upperchard, Seva Tower, Nutwood Farm. What's your website?
.com.
Nutwoodfarm.com. All right. Thank you so much for joining me on the New Rural Advocate and too many more conversations.
Thank you. Josh.